Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
I'm Charity Nebbe. This is an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Scientists have been warning us about the dangers of climate change for decades now, and every year, more and more people are dealing with the very real consequences of climate change. Violent storms, catastrophic flooding, extreme heat waves, drought, wildfires, and so much more. To try to slow the rate of climate change, the 197 countries that have endorsed the Paris Climate Agreement have pledged to reduce carbon emissions with a goal of becoming carbon neutral or reaching net zero emissions by 2050. People in many different fields are developing technologies that will make this possible, but a lot of people have questions. How will this change my life? What can I do now to reduce my carbon footprint? Is this an attack on our way of life? This hour, we are going to look into the future and talk about some of the ways our lives might change as we work toward net zero. I'll talk with green building consultant Martha Norbeck about adapting our homes and ethicist Brian Green about changing how we produce and eat our food. But we are going to start off with a conversation about how we will travel. Paul Erickson is manager of commercial energy solutions for Central Iowa Power Cooperative, and we're going to focus this conversation on electric vehicles. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And Paul, I know you've been really intensively researching the practical side of driving electric vehicles since 2017. And you started doing that on behalf of your customers to see how this would actually work in real life, right?
Yes, to be, you know, kind of an authority or a person that could help them out with questions that they might have, to get them over the fear of range anxiety, which is the fear of running out of battery before you get to your destination, and just see how that would affect also rates and if there's critical infrastructure that we have to change to absorb all that extra usage.
So these days you're driving a Chevy Bolt around the state of Iowa. Tell me a little bit about how you take this out and really put it through its paces to see how it would be to drive one of these.
Sure. Well, it drives like a normal car. There's a few differences where you don't feel anything shift into different gears. You don't hear any noise. So it could be sitting there and it could be on whether you knew it or not. Because there's no engine noise. When I go to different places to talk, a lot of times I'll look on the screen, on the website, to see how many miles it is, and then just estimate if I do have to charge somewhere in between, then I've got some time to do that, to take up some of my time while I'm waiting for the charge.
Well, and of course, you also have to, at this point in time, really make a plan so that you're somewhere you can charge your vehicle. How easy is that in Iowa right now in 2021?
It's fairly easy. You can get an app for your phone. You can look on the screen if you've got OnStar or something like that, that automatically will route you a path to the nearest charger. And there's different types of chargers, and when you get out on the road, they're starting to put more and more of these DC fast chargers, which are a level 3, and that can get you charge like 100 miles in my car, 100 miles in 30 minutes.
Okay.
And there's different levels of chargers, but they're starting to put them along the highway corridors, along Interstate 80 and some of the other highways to get people with that comfort that, you know, they're going to have a place to charge when they get to their location or before to get back home.
Yeah. Well, and of course, a lot of people on a day-to-day basis wouldn't outdrive their battery. But if we're going to be driving longer distances and adopting more kinds of electric vehicles, that's really important infrastructure to have. You mentioned kind of trying to see how this would work for your customers, but also for power production. So give me some insight into that. So far, electric vehicles have been pretty expensive to buy, significantly more expensive than combustion engine vehicles, but you find that they're a lot cheaper to drive.
Right. So if I was to look at some of the cars that I've had in the past, I would always get like 21 miles a gallon. And I was out yesterday putting some fuel into my gas tank at one of my cars, and I was getting it at $2.96. If I divide that by the 21 miles a gallon I usually get, that'd be 14 cents a mile. Now, when I charge my EV vehicle, I get an average price of about 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So, and out of that 1 kilowatt hour, I get about 4 miles. So that's 2.5 cents a mile compared to the 14 cents a mile that gas is at right now. And it looks like it's going to go up some more.
So. All right. So that can be a real money saver. People
right.
often would need a place to charge their vehicle at home. What kind of infrastructure do people need in their own garages to be able to support this?
Okay. All of the electric vehicles come with a plug-in charger, and it's a level one, and that would be off of any 120-volt outlet that you have in your garage you could plug into. The problem with that is you only get about 4 miles of distance per hour of charge. That's a level one. And then if you go to the next level, which a lot of the utilities have rebates for, and it helps you get 240 volt out to your garage, which 240 volt would be similar as if you have an electric water heater or an electric stove range type or electric clothes dryer. That would be 240, and that'll get you about 25 miles in an hour. So you could put that in your garage, and some of the things you could look at, 90% of the time you're going to charge at your own house. It's going to be at night. And the cars are made now that they can program so that you go home, plug it in at 5 o'clock, and maybe delay it until after a peak period is passed. Our peak period runs from 4 o'clock till 9 o'clock in the evening. So after 9 o'clock, it would start charging, and I would have, if I drove the average mileage, which is 30 miles a day as a commuter, I would have a total charge from 9 o'clock until 4:30, and I'd be fully charged again for the next day.
I have heard some people, some naysayers say, but, you know, you're still depending on electricity, which is dirty to produce. You know, power companies have their own issues with that. What are your thoughts about that?
Okay. So a lot of the power that we're getting in Iowa anymore is a lot driven by wind turbines. So it's not so much coal, but it's wind turbines, and we're getting a growth of solar panels. And the coal plants that we have today aren't the type that we had when I was a kid. You know, when you see a vapor coming out of a smokestack, that is vapor. It's water vapor. There's scrubbers and things that they put on the back of those coal units to clean them up so they don't pollute like they used to a long time ago. There is still, you know, some things that you have to clean up that we're trying to work around, but it's more and more clean energy is on the Iowa grid than ever before.
So let's look into the future. Like I said, electric vehicles have been expensive so far, and a lot of people are just priced out of that market.
Right.
What do you see changing?
Well, so if you look at first cost, it is a little bit of a bump. But on the other hand, you've got savings every time you have to recharge your battery, so you're not putting the expensive gasoline in there. You're saving on, you don't have any spark plugs, you don't have any oil changes, you don't have a tailpipe, you don't have a transmission system that could go out. And every day I get calls from the warranty people that say, hey, your warranty's almost up. And I go, you don't realize what car I've got. So there's all those things that over the life of the vehicle, you'll be saving money with an electric vehicle.
I think some people also think, well, I love driving my SUV. If you drive around Iowa, the majority of the vehicles I think you see are trucks. And
sure.
You're driving around in a little Chevy Bolt right now. So what does that look like on the horizon? Are we going to be able to drive the kinds of vehicles that we seem to want to drive, but they're going to be EV?
There are vehicles that are coming out either they're SUVs, they're minivans, There's pickup trucks, four-wheel drive. All of those are into play. And, you know, Ford will be coming out with their pickups next year. Rivian's already starting to roll cart trucks off the line for delivery this year. Even the Humvee vehicle is going to be a battery operated one. I have a friend that had a gave me a ride to the Iowa football game the other day, and her Jeep, her four-door Jeep, is a hybrid. So it's got gas and it's got a battery. And I know she always gets upset when she has to go over to gas, because she's getting that 30 miles a day, basically not free, but at a very low cost, just by plugging it in.
So you've been watching this market really closely. How soon do you think we are going to see a real shift? I mean, we certainly see a lot of early adopters on the road right now.
Right. And it'll continue like that, but it's not going to be the faster transition that you would have like in maybe the East Coast or the West Coast, where fuel prices and emissions are really more of a problem or a challenge to them. They'll be the early adopters, but we'll have some change and you'll start to notice them. And it's very interesting once we get the pickup trucks, because that was always a big stumbling block for, well, I've got a trailer to pull, or I've got I need four-wheel drive in the wintertime or something. But that's all coming, and it should be relevant, you know, next year. But it'll still take a long time to convert over to all electric.
Well, and as of right now, it's still really challenging to buy EVs in Iowa.
It is. You know, one of the big makers, Tesla, doesn't have a marketing system or a dealer network in Iowa. And I think that goes against one of the laws they have. If you're going to buy a vehicle, you're going to have some kind of support system. So they don't have it. So you either have to go to a used car dealership, or you have to go to Minneapolis or Chicago or something like that
so
to get.
There's still quite a bit of infrastructure that we need to make this work, but it's coming our way. Paul Erickson, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Charity.
Paul Erickson is manager of commercial energy solutions for Central Iowa Power Cooperative. This hour, we're talking about how our lives may change as we try to achieve net zero emissions. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Charity Nebbe, and you're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Net zero by 2050. That's the goal that 197 countries, including the United States, signed onto with the Paris Climate Agreement. It means achieving a balance between the greenhouse gases put into the atmosphere and those taken out. And we have a long way to go to get there. This hour, we are imagining that net zero future and how our lives might change as we work to achieve it. In about 15 minutes, I'll talk about the future of food production and consumption with ethicist Brian Green. But right now, we're going to talk about how our homes need to change. Martha Norbeck is the founder of Seawise, a green building consulting company based in Iowa City. Hello, Martha.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I think a lot of emphasis on sort of green technologies for buildings has focused on building green, but most of us live in homes that already exist. So let's focus on how the homes we already have might need to change. If you, I know that you moved into a home and retrofitted it and turned it into a much greener home. So talk me through some of the real focal points of trying to make our homes more energy efficient and really help us move toward net zero.
Sure. Sure. Well, my home is 578 square feet, and it was originally built in 1904. And so that gives you some idea. Our housing stock has been around a long time, and buildings haven't changed dramatically. So the guts of the buildings are going to change, but how they look isn't going to be dramatically different. My home is currently operating at net zero. During 6-7 months of the year, I'm producing more energy from the panels on my roof than I'm consuming, and I bike everywhere. So my transportation and my living are net zero. So some of this stuff is possible today. And one of the big pieces that is going to come into play for homeowners is the transition to what's called beneficial electrification. And so that's the process of, say, you know, 85% of the people who replace their water heaters do it on an emergency basis. So they haven't really thought about what they're going to do when they replace their water heater. Similarly for our air conditioners and furnaces. But if we planned ahead to get an all-electric substitution, an electric heat pump furnace or a heat pump water heater that's all electric, we're going to be well on the road towards net zero just by making those two choices.
All right. Well, and I live in a very old farmhouse, and everything here is electric because we're out in the middle of nowhere. And how you heat your house with something that's electric, that makes a really big difference as far as efficiency. I know, because when we moved in here, we had electric baseboard heaters, and we had to move to a heat pump solution just to be able to afford our electric bill every month.
Absolutely.
So you have to be careful about that, right?
Yes, very careful. Yes. Electric resistance is very inefficient, but the heat pump technology has advanced so much that most homes can actually just do a switchover with their standard furnace and air AC unit, actually just put in an all-electric air-to-air heat pump solution. You don't need to do holes in your ground for ground source heat pump. You can get an efficient operation with that switch today.
So in your home, I know that you have solar panels on the roof. You also live in a small home, a significantly smaller home than most people probably aspire to. So we need to talk about that as well. And I think some people are a little intimidated by that. Like, do we have to produce our own electricity to reach this net zero goal? Or is this something that we can depend on power companies for?
Well, that's actually a great question. So in Iowa, we're progressing very rapidly. So in 2020, 1% of the electricity produced in Iowa was from wind energy and wind and solar. Today, it is 57%. That's in 20 years. We've gone from 1% to 57%. It's been a rapid change. And MidAmerican is last year, 83% of their electricity delivered was produced by wind. So yeah, if you live in MidAmerican territory, your electricity is much, much cleaner. And so putting solar panels in your house may not make as much sense as it does perhaps in a different territory.
Do we need to develop ways to store electricity in our homes? I mean, we were just talking about EVs, and of course, that's all based on battery power storage.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Batteries are going to play a huge role in this. So one of the challenges when you think about this dramatic shift is batteries and solar panels and electric vehicles do not self-actualize. They require materials to be produced. We have to mine them. We have to destroy habitat to do that mining. A lot of that mining is happening in countries that are going to be dramatically negatively affected by that mining. So there is a lot of exciting research on the battery front and the solar panel front. And so a massive investment in R&D to come up with solutions for batteries and solar power that rely on readily available materials like seawater and carbon and silicone, that would be a game changer. Because if we proceed on the plan of we're just going to replace everything with the technology we have today, we're going to have other consequences. So yeah, all right, so our power in our homes might be less dirty, but the footprint of producing that power is really ugly.
Yeah. Well, and I know that one of the places where we are producing a lot of emissions and have historically been producing a lot of emissions are with cooling systems, with air conditioners, with our refrigerators, that kind of thing. Where do you see a shift there? We already talked about the heat pump technology, which of course can help a lot with emissions with air conditioning. But where do you see us moving to really mitigate that factor?
Well, that is an exciting topic because the EPA is issuing a new regulation imminently for hydrofluorocarbons, so refrigerants, and it's continuing what some people know as the Montreal Protocol, which was a global agreement to reduce the impact of refrigerants on our climate. And that's going to be a game changer, and I'm already seeing it. So Hy-Vee is investing in CO2-based refrigeration. So they're actually using CO2 to power the refrigerant cycle of their units, their refrigeration units in their and some of their stores. That's very exciting progress. So I see great hope for reducing our impact through changes in refrigerant.
Is that something you've taken on in your own home?
I have a what's called a mini split. It's an air-to-air heat pump. It has a relatively standard refrigerant. So when I purchased it 5 years ago, the more aggressive refrigerants literally weren't available, except for you know, specialty things. But because of this new EPA rule, that's going to change dramatically soon.
Let's talk about making our homes more efficient, because it's one thing to get a heat pump system or something like that. But if your home is leaky and drafty and all of those things, then heating is still going to be a larger draw than it should be. So talk to me about building envelopes and changing that kind of design in our homes that already exist.
Sure. A lot of people, the first thing they want to ask me about is replacing their windows. But we need to bear in mind that a window is a hole in the wall that is lightly covered by glass. Glass is terrible at controlling the flow of heat. It just moves readily across the glass. So even the best windows today are still pretty lousy at controlling heat flow. So we want to focus on the rest of the building. We want to focus on controlling leaks. We want to focus on insulation. And Green Iowa AmeriCorps in multiple cities in Iowa offers home energy audits. There are also other companies that will come and do home energy audits for a fee. And they can test the leakage of your home and give you a list of recommendations for upgrades. Typically what winds up happening is, you know, insulation is typically the first thing. And then you can start looking at your leaky doors and the band joist, which is what goes around kind of at the bottom of your house, like a band. And that typically just leaks like crazy. If you take a thermal imaging camera on it, it's usually glowing red. So there's a lot, if you have an energy audit, you can start to see some of those opportunities with the help of those professionals.
And, you know, of course, a lot of us get our siding replaced and you know, get the wrap of the house and some of that basic stuff or the insulation that, you know, is applied in numerous ways. Do you, looking at some of these technologies, are the things that you see that are most effective or something that maybe you should make a priority if you're trying to make your home greener?
Yeah, so one of the you know, my disclaimer here is that once you start to tighten your home, you could be introducing moisture issues. So make sure to work with professionals, ask them, how is this going to affect moisture in my home? If they can't answer that, you probably want to ask somebody else. It's really important to talk about moisture because you don't want mold in your home. But if you are replacing your siding, it's a great opportunity to basically wrap your house in rigid insulation. It will tighten up the walls and it will compensate for any weaknesses in your insulation that's in your walls. That's a really good opportunity. And as far as what the best siding is, that is too complicated to get into it. And this, in this time frame.
All right, maybe a whole nother show about siding another time.
Yes.
So a lot of the homes that have been built in recent years follow a very similar pattern where, you know, we see maybe a big great hall. People do gravitate toward larger homes. These homes that we're building right now, are they more difficult to make greener than some of the older homes?
So the bigger the house, the more energy required to operate it, the more materials required to build it. I find the trend in ever-increasing home sizes deeply disturbing. The bottom line is, if we think we can just switch out technology and solve all our problems, if we think that's the solution, we're kidding ourselves. The reality is, if we don't reduce how much we use, if we don't reduce how much we consume, nature's going to do it for us. Nature's going to whip us into shape. And the faster we can recognize the need to change the way we think about how we live, the faster we'll be able to rein in some of those emissions. And that rate of change is really going to determine the future for us and our children and our grandchildren. The faster we can rein that in, the better success we're going to have in slowing that rate of change.
I think people who live in older buildings and are really interested in greener technologies, some people feel like maybe it's best to tear down what they have and build something new. What's your perspective on that?
My perspective is that there are so much energy bound up into an existing building. If there's any way to retain what you have or the majority of what you have, that really is the ideal way to go. It's messy, but it's really fun because you can come up with solutions you wouldn't come up with new construction. My first go-to on any project, whether commercial or residential, is can we keep this? How much of this can we keep? We want to honor the materials that have already been extracted and manufactured and the energy that went into them.
One of the big problems right now with green building and retrofitting is that it's expensive and it, you know, has been limited to people of means. And yet all people really need this kind of technology and it can save you a lot of money in the long run. How do you see the equity problem shifting?
No, that is a fabulous point. And I think that gets back to some of your earlier questions of, you know, what technologies are most likely to get us there. And I do think a lot of the things we were just discussing about upgrading your building envelope, the cost on that is prohibitive and it's complicated because every home is unique. I think what we're probably going to wind up seeing is the shift in our grid. So the utilities are going to do a dramatic shift. And then the other big piece is going to be that shift to electrification. And then that ties into the electrical vehicles, like you said, we're speaking of earlier. Then we can use those batteries on our property as an energy source in peak load to help the grid be able to handle spikes in demand. And so we can actually use our heat pump water heater and our car batteries to help the grid provide that renewable energy to us.
Which would make us more resilient in some of these extreme storms, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the big piece is we're going to have to pay for people. Somehow we're going to have to find the money to pay for people's new furnaces and water heaters to advance that beneficial electrification, because otherwise the equity piece falls apart and we're just exacerbating that divide. So that is, I know that is one of the conversations happening with some of the legislation in the works, is we need to figure out how to help people who cannot afford these changes to make those changes possible, because they're not just benefiting the individual, they're benefiting the entire community in that speeding up our transition.
We only have about a minute left, and we've been focusing on our homes, but you also want us to think about our lawns and what's going on outside our homes, right?
Yes, very quickly. So as we our climate changes, we're stressing our ecosystems. And so I dream of the future of where instead of people hiring a lawn service, you're hiring a habitat service. And so you have prairie plants in your yard and you have fruit trees and you're supporting habitat to basically help the birds and bugs and butterflies cushion themselves against the rate of climate change.
And that is a place where I think a lot of us don't think about the emissions that come from lawn care. We've talked a lot about habitat and support for pollinators on Talk of Iowa over the years, but we've never focused on talking about emissions that may be coming from lawn care. Martha, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Martha Norbeck is the founder of Seawise, a green building consulting company based in Iowa City. This hour, we are talking about the goal of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. That's a goal that 197 countries, including the U.S., have signed onto with the Paris Climate Agreement. So we're talking about what that means for our lives, our day-to-day lives. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about our food systems.
I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to the conversation in a moment. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are imagining a more sustainable future in which we reach carbon neutral or zero emissions by 2050. That's the goal set out in the Paris Climate Agreement, and all kinds of technologies and methods are being developed right now to help us get there. Today, we've been talking about how our lives might change as we work toward this goal, and now we're going to talk about our food system. Brian Green is Director of Technology Ethics at Marcola Center for Applied Ethics, part of Santa Clara University in California. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And of course, talking about our food system, we could do that for many hours with many, many guests. So we're going to try to keep it relatively simple today.
Yes.
But this is really big and for a lot of people, scary issue here in Iowa. And I want to start, instead of with how things are going to need to change to reach these goals, I want to start with the dangers of climate change for agriculture, because it's already making it harder to farm, right?
Absolutely. There are so many, huge problems that are really happening with climate change, whether it's drought or flooding or more powerful storms. One of the ways that I like to talk about climate change is that it's like putting the weather on steroids, right? You can think of when baseball was having its problem with steroids. There were so many more home runs being hit, and the home runs were going farther. And the thing about that is you can't attribute any particular home run to climate change, but you know that it's happening, right? It's happening, having an effect. And it's the same thing with climate change. If the climate is changing and becoming more energetic overall, then you're going to have more storms. They're going to be more powerful storms. You can't blame any particular event specifically on climate change, but you know it's having an effect. It's having an overall negative effect on the way that we can do anything in this world, because we're really we've built our infrastructure and everything with these expectations about how the climate is supposed to work. And when that starts changing, then that becomes a real problem because we're not prepared for it.
Right. Well, and as you're saying, I mean, that doesn't mean that every year, every growing season is going to be bad or have something catastrophic in it. And there may be even some short-term benefits in some places, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it's really uneven, right? The way climate change is operating is it makes the entire climate system more energetic across the entire planet, right? So in some places, it'll be getting hotter, but in other places, it could be getting colder. You can think about, every time there's a really cold winter, say, people say, oh, what happened to climate change? Well, the truth is maybe that cold air ended up where it did because it was pushed down from the north or from some other direction where there usually wouldn't be enough energy to push that kind of cold air. So that it's really it's difficult to conceptualize in a lot of ways, just because there's so many different things happening all at once. Many people have said we shouldn't really call it climate change. We should call it climate disruption, or they've come up with different words for it. Whatever word you use, the main thing to remember is that this is just it's a big difference, right? Things are going to be different than the way they've been before.
So we know that food production worldwide produces about 25% of world greenhouse gas emissions, and that meat and dairy production makes up about 14.5% of world greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization. Now, some people learn that and they say, oh, well, it's easy. Everybody should become vegan. And of course, that can be a very good choice for some people, but others really cannot fathom that idea. It's a total deal breaker. And of course, here in Iowa, producing meat and dairy, that's a really big part of our way of life. And it can really break down the conversation to even kind of go there off the start. So where do we start with this conversation about making our food system more sustainable and reaching net zero?
So that is a great question. And it's a huge issue. You're absolutely right. And it's not just Iowa, right? It's everywhere in the world that grows that grows food and plants and animals. The way I like to think about it is that you can think of food as being kind of a concentrated form of solar energy, right? The farms are out there in the sun. They're absorbing solar energy. They're turning it into chemical bonds that we then digest, or we feed it to animals and the animals eat it. You have to think about the efficiency of the system, right? In the past, the world was not so limited in terms of what efficiency we needed, right? When you have a smaller population, lower resource demands, that inefficiency wasn't such a big deal. But as there are more and more people in the world, and as we're having a larger and larger environmental impact, we really have to think about efficiency now. And feeding animals, or rather, if we're sending our food through animals before we eat it ourselves, that's just inefficient. That doesn't mean that everybody needs to become vegan. It doesn't mean that everybody needs to never eat any meat. However, we need to start thinking about the inefficient use of energy that represents, right? And we need to think about, are there ways that we can make this system more efficient? And also pricing in the damage from that, right? If we're talking about 25% of climate change being because of agriculture, then maybe we need to think about pricing 25% of the damage of climate change into agriculture. Mm.
Well, and I think that when we have these conversations, we sort of forget about the inputs into agriculture. And of course, you know, farmers are out there working hard all the time and they're driving big vehicles because they have to. And, you know, all kinds of other things and the kinds of applications that are made to fields and things like that throughout the year. That's a big part of all of these equations. And vehicles have to be a big part of the conversation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as your first guest was mentioning, these are it's an important part of the energy system, right? Everything having to do with transportation is energy intensive because you're moving from place to place and that requires energy. And when you're talking about a farm, if you're talking about driving a large tractor or other vehicles across a farm, that requires a lot of energy. And the fertilizer that goes into the farm requires energy. Any pesticides or herbicides that are applied require energy. There's so much energy intensivity involved in agriculture, and it's not like we can just stop, right? We can't just stop this because we need it. We need food. You can't stop something like that. So the question is, how do you change the system in such a way that you can get the benefits that we need to have, that we can make the changes that we need to do, and at the same time not cause such a disruption that we're harming ourselves, that we don't want to harm our farmers. We don't want to harm everybody else who's involved in the agricultural system.
There have been just incredible advances in precision agriculture in recent years and recent decades that have made it possible for, you know, farmers to farm larger operations and get a whole lot of work done in shorter spans of time and things like that and apply things in a much more precise way as well. Do you see precision ag playing into our goals at making farming more sustainable?
So this is actually, it's a remarkable trend, and it's just going to continue this trend towards more and more precision and more automation, really. For example, in California, there are startups who are working on robotic tractors, right? Self-driving tractors. That's one thing. But the kind of the next step is very precise applications of fertilizer or very precise applications of pesticides or herbicides based on machine learning algorithms that are on the underside of the tractor. They look at everything in the field as the tractor goes over it, and they say that's a weed. They spray it very precisely, or they say, oh, that's a non-beneficial insect that recognizes this using artificial intelligence, and then sprays it with a tiny jet of pesticide, you know, just enough to kill it. And you can really minimize the amount used by using that artificial intelligence to be very, very precise in a way that a human, you know, how much labor would that require? It would require an incredible amount of labor. Humans would never want to put that amount of labor into it. But if you can automate it, suddenly it becomes possible. However, that, of course, also uses energy. And that raises the question of where is the energy coming from on the farm? Can it be solar powered? Can it be wind powered and things like that?
Well, and also, of course, precision agriculture technologies that have taken off. And what you're talking about doesn't sound that space age to me, considering the kinds of amazing things farmers are already doing with precision ag. But, you know, what's driving precision ag is because it is cost effective. The cost benefit
right.
analysis comes out on the right side. That seems like something that's a little risky there as well when you're looking at you know, some of these technologies that go even farther.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point, right, which is that the cost-benefit analysis has to work out in the right direction. If it doesn't work out in the right direction, it's not going to happen. And so we need to think about what incentive structures we can build in order to make sure that it's easier to do the right thing. One of the things I like to think about in terms of social ethics is how do we make it easier to do the right thing? How do we make, ultimately, how do we build a world where doing good is the easy thing to do instead of the hard thing to do? Because right now we haven't necessarily built the world that way, or we built the world that way for the past, mm-hmm. right, for decades ago, and not for the present or the future, which we're moving into.
So I want to move into another part of this conversation and talk about carbon sequestration, because, of course, farmers are out there working the land less and less because no-till farming is growing by leaps and bounds. And, of course, a lot of farmers have been doing that now for decades. But carbon sequestration is something that you see going hand in hand with agriculture. Tell me more about your ideas about that.
So this isn't just my idea. This is something that's become a whole research area, which is the idea of farms can really, once again, if you think of a farm as being basically a large solar energy installation, or however you want to conceive of it, is with the plants being the solar panels, and they're collecting that energy from the sun. They're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, and they're turning it into plant material. You can then take that material. You can turn it, if you do the right process through chemical pyrolysis. Basically, you take those materials, you heat them up in an environment with no oxygen, you basically turn them into charcoal. And you can take that charcoal then, which is called biochar because it comes from biological sources, you can take that biochar and then sequester it, whether that means plowing it into your field or whether it means doing something else with it where it becomes sequestered and no longer becomes part of the atmosphere. You can actually take a huge amount of CO2 out of the atmosphere each year by doing that. And it's actually a energy positive process. In other words, you can create a tiny power plant effectively on the farm where you are creating this biochar. It produces more energy than it consumes. So obviously it takes energy to heat up the plant material, to drive off the water, to turn it into charcoal. But as you're doing that, it releases volatile compounds, which can be burned, which then make the process self-sustaining. And then once you get your charcoal at the end, it's sequestered inorganic carbon, and it shouldn't enter the atmosphere again for a very long time. They've found these archaeological sites in the Amazon rainforest. It turns out there used to be a lot of human farming activity in the Amazon, and they can find the soil of that, which contains charcoal, and it's been there for centuries now. So we know this is a time-tested process for removing CO2 from the atmosphere for long periods of time.
Well, and I know that agricultural researchers are researching right now to figure out if biochar can be beneficial for crops as well.
Right.
But that sounds like something that could become an additional source of income for farmers.
If the system is set up with the right incentives, yes, absolutely.
So net zero, of course, doesn't mean that we do away with all emissions. It means reaching that balance where the emissions that we're producing are, you know, equal to the things that are balanced out through sequestration and other efforts to take gases out of the atmosphere. So do you ever see a place where we can do zero emission farming?
I think so. I think that actually, I mean, this needs to be the goal overall for entire human civilization, right? We need to be not just carbon neutral. We need to be carbon negative. We need to be producing regenerative and restorative, restoring our environment, making the world ultimately get the CO2 out of the atmosphere, kind of restore us to the way we were 100 years ago in terms of atmospheric composition. And that's something that farms can absolutely be involved in, because once again, farms are responsible for taking a huge amount of CO2 out of the atmosphere every year. And then if that can be sequestered, that's a fantastic thing. That's really, really good for the entire planet. And if everybody on the planet's doing that, then we're going to get CO2 out of the atmosphere much, much faster than if we are not doing it. And we really need an all of the above approach to the problem, right? We can't just say we're going to solve this through power plants, or we can't just say we're going to solve this through transportation. We really need to solve it through every means possible.
Now, and we're already seeing this as well, but this is something that you're a big proponent of, an increase in using farmland to produce energy like wind energy and solar energy in concert with food production, right?
Exactly. There's so much land that's available there to not only have the plants harvesting solar energy, but you can have solar energy to run your farm. Every farm is basically, we should start thinking of those being a power plant, right? They've got the solar energy, they've got the wind energy, they've got the plants that they can use for biomass energy or for turning into biochar with the residue from that process. There's just actually, farmland is awash in energy. And so the question is, can we harvest that in an efficient way and, distribute it to the world? We don't need to just be thinking of these big centralized power plants anymore. We can really think of a decentralized energy network where Iowa is, producing so much energy that it can share it with with Minneapolis or share it with Chicago. There's so many opportunities here.
And again, I know that this conversation can go in many different directions, but while you don't see livestock production disappearing, do you see it getting to be less of a factor in food production in around the world? And we know that a lot of people are proponents of eating less meat.
I mean, that's a big issue, right? And meat has such a strong cultural element to it. And I think, once again, we just have to think to ourselves, how much is it worth to us, right? Do we want to be keeping that as one of the pieces of the system that we are okay with that level of inefficiency, like I was saying, because it is inefficient. It's just overall energy inefficient. You can still have meat, but maybe the prices are going to go up. And that, of course, is going to impede people from eating it. People are going to want to eat meat, and they're maybe going to say, no, that's too expensive. I don't want to. But this is a reality that we have to face, right? We have to choose what we want to keep and what we want to change.
How fast do you see agriculture really embracing some of these big changes?
Well, I mean, one of the things about an industry that's completely necessary that you can't stop for even a year is that there's a certain amount tradition or a conservative or conservationist element to it, right? You don't want to just change things too fast or you could make a big mistake. On the other hand, one of the great things about American agriculture is that we are so productive. We have so much extra food, really, in a lot of ways. So I think that there's an opportunity there because we have a very resilient and robust system in many ways. There's an opportunity to change faster, certainly much faster than, say, a subsistence farmer in South America or in India or in Africa. They don't have that resilience.
Brian, we are out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Green is Director of Technology Ethics at Marcola Center for Applied Ethics, part of Santa Clara University in California. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.